Hello, I'm Mariet Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others. Introducing you to wellness professionals ready to assist with sincerity and care. Today's topic is ADHD is a creative superpower, not a curse. My guest is Dr. Albert Bramante, talent agent, performance psychologist, college professor, and author from New York in the US. Welcome on the show, Albert.
Thank you so much, Mariette, for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
And to our listeners, it's good of you to join us. After our conversation, it will be fun question time. Albert, you've been described as not your usual Hollywood talent agent. Tell us more about the different aspects of your work.
Okay, so I work with actors. So the primary responsibility of an agent is to secure work on a day-to-day basis for our clients, which are actors. And I serve New York. And so the actors that are in New York are looking for work. And when they come to us or come to an agent, the primary responsibility or day-to-day is to find appropriate employment opportunities for them. And that includes film opportunities, TV, theater, Broadway musicals, as well as commercials, adverts, voiceover, and print campaigns. Now, typically, the stereotype, as is indicated, of agents is very sometimes cold, money hungry, and really just motivated at the bottom line. Now, what is true about our business is we only make a percentage off of our clients. So technically, when we take a client on or we sign a client on, we are really working free initially, because unless the actor gets paid, we don't, you know, see any return on that investment. So we are going to be selective. Now, for me, because of my background in psychology, because of my background in mindset work, I tend to take on a more managerial, caring persona, which now there are a lot of agents who care. So I don't want to say that all agents are strictly at the bottom line. We do care about our clients, and especially I do. And what I like to do, one of my philosophies has always been to give back as much as I can. So I will give a lot of advice out and experience and even tips for other actors that aren't on my roster to really enhance and work the business. So what for me, I like to go the extra mile and look at my actors, my clients, as not just commodities or items, but more of people that have real feelings, dreams, and other dimensions rather than just, hey, you're an actor, book, you know, make me money. So that's the end of the day, in the sense for me, is I look at them as people and important people. They worked hard, and it's a very tough business to work in this industry.
Yes, and I mean, you are very different because you have the background in psychology. How did you come to study psychology?
Well, I was always a very curious, inquisitive child. So I loved to read ever since I was in grammar school. I loved to read, and I was always very curious-minded into science. And I started, when I was in high school, I started reading a lot of books about the brain and nervous system and human behavior. And I just became so immensely engrossed and interested in this that I wanted to study this professionally. So I decided to major in psychology. And when I was in high school, especially towards my senior year, I was determined to be a clinical psychologist, which means I was going to go have a practice. My goal was to get a PhD and to teach. And that was like my goal when I was in high school, you know, the end of my high school year. And So I majored in psychology, and then I went to get my master's right after I received my undergrad degree. And so it was still very heavily into psychology and behavior. So that was like kind of what led me down the rabbit hole of psychology, in a sense.
Right. Now, today we're talking about ADHD as a creative superpower, not a curse. Before we talk about that, could you tell us what happened to you in seventh grade?
Okay. So, well, I've had, just to give you a background, I did have a lot of challenges as a child. And one of the defining moments was I was enrolled in, obviously, you know, in homeroom, and I had the same English teacher initially. So the first week or so, she had called a meeting, my former English teacher and homeroom mentor, decided to call a meeting in with all my other teachers, my other subject teachers, and my parents. Now, of course, I wasn't privy to the meeting. And in the meeting, she had proceeded to tell my parents that I shouldn't be in a regular class. I should be in a self-contained classroom. And that I should be in a very low section. Now, thankfully, and I still thank my parents to this day, they didn't listen. And as a matter of fact, about 2 weeks later, I was removed from a class and went to another English class. And to me, that was a defining moment. Even though at the time, it really didn't feel like it. But so later that year, we had to take a placement test to get into the next grade. And not only did I do well, I tested into the top section in eighth grade. So it was my first moment to say, so I was like in the honors section in eighth grade. So I went from being told I was going to be in a self-contained classroom to honors in less than a year. And I attribute to that because of my parents' belief, and that instilled that into me. So I am really fortunate that my parents fought and didn't just give in.
And I think that has given you a lot of understanding for people who tend to be perceived as different. I did notice that you describe yourself as neurodivergent, and you regard that as your superpower.
Yes. Now, I tend to be I'm very sensitive. I consider myself to be an empath. And I also have I don't like to sit still. Mm-hmm. So, and I like to do a lot of things at one point, which some people may label as a problem in by conventional means, but I like to have my hands into different things, involved in different things. And that's why I feel like I'm able to do a lot, because I'm able to kind of go from different vantage points. So for me, one thing I started to notice over time, I became very bored easily. If I'm not interested, like in a presentation or a lecture, I tend to always daydream. Not by choice. It was just, I would zone out. Or I would just be focusing on so many other things. So that was kind of like my first foray into that. So even as in primary school and junior high, I would always get even chastised by teachers to stop daydreaming. And it wasn't by choice. It was just something that just, if I'm not fully engaged, I tend to tune out. I mean, obviously I have a lot of methods to work on it today, but at that time I didn't, you know, I really didn't understand what was happening. But I attribute that a lot today. And even my work with people, because also my background has been as a college professor, I've encountered, you know, students that were, you know, obviously now over 18, but that were classified in high school or even in junior high as special needs. And I have to tell you, a lot of times these students are even brighter and more talented than the average students in the class.
Yes, that's why I'm so glad we're having the discussion today.
Mm-hmm.
Albert, let's get to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. How would you define ADHD?
So ADHD, I mean, if you want to look at the clinical definition, it's the ability to hold sustained attention in a long period of time. Now, what I often think, it's an overdiagnosed condition, that it's labeled as a problem. And typically, it's like if the student or child is not able to learn in a traditional way.
Mm-hmm.
They're labeled as ADHD, or they can't sit still. The way I look at it, and again, this is just my own opinion, because even though I wasn't officially diagnosed as ADHD, I would think I would have been had I been tested. I have that strong hunch. What I will say is it's difficult for sustained attention for a long period of time. So the one thing for me, like the way to keep attention is sometimes if I'm moving around, if I'm tapping or doing something, that'll keep me focused. Because if I sit still and let's say I'm hearing a lecture or I'm hearing something, I will tune out. Even if I'm interested, I just find myself automatically tuning out. And so rather than labeling it as a problem and feeding that medication, I feel like what we need to do is figure out alternative ways to sustain that attention. And that's why movement is so important. So like for me, like for example, if I'm listening to a podcast or an audiobook, I find I'm better able to retain the information if I'm moving, if I'm walking, rather than sitting still or lying down. So I think it's just a way of processing information differently.
Yes.
And also I would kind of even add now today in the digital age with technology and with social media and all and the instant gratification, we're going to see more and more ADHD diagnoses coming out. And I use diagnosis in quotation marks.
Yeah. My next question is, how is ADHD generally viewed in society? You have made a few comments now that it tends to be overdiagnosed and so on, but how would you describe the general view of this in society?
The general view is it's a problem. The general view is that it's a weakness or a handicap, and that because it is classified as a disorder. And it is classified as needing special interventions or special ed. And so there's a stigma attached. And most, at least in America and in the States, the primary way to treat, at least by standards, care is by giving a child Ritalin, Adderall, or any other type of stimulant to help them remain focused. Now, I've never taken these stimulants, and I will never do that. That's my personal choice. However, I do know that they're starting to find out they may not be entirely effective. And there's cost to that. Because I've seen kids who are prescribed these stimulants, and they're like zombies, where they're just their personality is stripped. They may be docile and calm and what you want to do by sitting and being still, but they're not living the life that a child should have, because children have a lot of energy already naturally and they have a natural playful thing. So sitting for 6 hours in school, it's not natural for a child, even from an evolutionary standpoint, because children are designed to have a lot of energy. I mean, that was how they were real. I mean, that's how we were kind of built. So to sit there and say, medicate, oh, this is the problem. You know, it almost gives an excuse for educators and psychologists to not really work hard as hard. And not every child learns the same. So rather than focusing so much on here's a pill to take, what we need to be doing is tailoring interventions, okay? Presenting the information differently, moving around, rather than sitting still for 6 hours. And that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and added to that, you have written that it is a creative superpower, not a curse.
Yes, because it allows you, it enables you to do a lot of great things. And I often think if you look at the greatest inventors or innovators of our time, they were often classified, at least by people around them, as being different-minded, which might at that time, even though, if we look at the historical time, differently-minded might be the same day as neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Although that term wasn't really available, maybe in the last 10, 15 years or prior to that, it wasn't available. It was just you think differently. And that, because we have that inability to kind of like think literally in a linear fashion, we tend to think in different ways. And that's where true creativity comes in, because creativity is all about coming up with innovative solutions or innovative thoughts to conventional patterns or conventional problems. So by having that distractibility and by having that, that extra stimulation in our brain and our mind, it really requires us sometimes to be creative, and being creative can come up with innovative solutions.
Now, individuals with ADHD often display traits they are taught to hide. Could you discuss some of these traits?
So they're often told to be not as impulsive. That's the biggest thing, is the impulsivity aspect of things. Like in the classroom, a child automatically thinks the answer, they blurt it out. Or they raise their hand and they're really excited to answer the question. So you'll see them in their chair, sometimes dancing and tapping their feet and, jumping up and down, because they really want to answer the question, are excited by that. And what we tend to do is the teachers will, behave yourself, Johnny, sit in your chair, be quiet. And what that does is it stifles the child, because the child is genuinely excited to give that information. They're really excited to present their knowledge. Now, of course, we can, work on teaching, taking turns and being respectful. But at the same time, we don't want to stifle creativity by saying, be quiet. And at least in the generation I grew up in, and it's a little bit better now, but the generation I grew up in was, children were seen, not heard. So it was like, okay, be quiet, be a good little boy or be a good little girl, and don't speak in turn. So that would be a really significant way that we tend to stifle or block the aspects by really discouraging that child from speaking up and from being genuinely interested or passionate about it. And so this is why we all, when they get into high school and even college, they really have very low self-confidence in the process.
Yeah. And in an attempt to address the issue of low self-confidence, you have written that people who are neurodivergent should redefine success and failure.
Yes. So redefining, the whole idea to redefine success, success is different for everybody. Success can be really defined as doing what you love and doing what makes you happy. And then failure can be defined as learning experiences, as feedback, as a stepping stone to success, not setbacks. So it's important for us to look at and label our failures as stepping stones and feedback to get us closer to the goals that we want to get to.
You help clients and students who are neurodivergent create systems that honor the way their brain works. Could you mention some of these practical tips?
So, we were taught at an early age in school, not to work with any distraction, like not to do work with TV on or with music. Some people cannot really do any work, quiet work, without TV or music going in the background. So I know a lot of people, even myself, a lot of times when I was in school, if I was working on a paper, if I was working on a task that required attention, I needed some background noise. I needed the music on it. I needed the radio on. I needed the TV on. And it helped me focus more. Now, some people, maybe it can be a distraction. But for me and for some people, that is what we need, that extra stimulation. Also, taking breaks, you know, working sustained action is really not useful. So, like, you know, blocking time out. Okay, 20 minutes work, 5 minute break. 20 minute work, 5 minute break. That could be a system. Or even an hour, if you're doing an hour blocks, 50 minutes could be work, 10 minutes should be doing something else. Completely different. And we've even found, like, a lot of, you know, studies have been done that real people learn better that way or study that way. And the information retains more efficiently when we're able to block out time to take breaks, rather than sitting there and saying, okay, I'm going to study for 10 hours straight. For most people, that's not going to work.
And how about rigid schedules?
I think there should be some flexibility there, but schedules are helpful. So you can set days out and say, okay, I'm going to block this time out to study. I'm going to block out this time out to look at my emails. I'm going to block out this time to read. I'm going to block out this time for family time. And it's important to kind of keep a schedule. Now, things change. Life changes. Day-to-day situation can change. So having a little bit of flexibility is important. But it's good to have the system set up, rather than just randomly, okay, I'm just going to wing it, and which is what most people do. I get up today, I don't have a system, I'm just going to, now I'm going to sit and answer emails, now I'm going to do this, now I'm going to do that, and then a lot of times we don't get a lot done that we set out to do. So having a system in place is great, and a schedule in place.
Albert, could you offer examples of individuals who have reframed the so-called drawback of ADHD and achieved success?
So, yeah, I recently had a conversation with someone. He's an 85-year-old man who really didn't discover his power or his potential until his mid-60s. In life, he had completed only up to seventh grade education in his other country. He wasn't from the U.S. He was from Austria. And it wasn't until he read a book about ADHD in the early 90s when he was in his late 60s. And it really became evident to him that this is what he had. And so instead of letting it define him, now he wrote several books. He, you know, does so many different other projects. And he built him an empire because he was able to have his hands in so many different things. He didn't look at it as a weakness anymore. It was now a chance of saying, okay, I have the potential to do so much because of my ADHD. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking at it as a problem.
Note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life by interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, marietsneeman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. The section Up Close and Personal on my website offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients, or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. Now, back to my guest. And speaking of books, in 2024, you published your book, Rise Above the Script, Confronting Self-Doubt and Mastering Self-Sabotage for Performing Artists. Would you like to say more about your book?
Sure. So my book came out of necessity because when I was going for my PhD, I started my talent agency. The one thing that I kept running up against, or many actors were self-sabotaging. And what I mean by self-sabotaging, I mean like being our own worst enemy, holding themselves behind, and really just really not working as hard as can be. That was a thing that kept coming up. And it was, they're really being their own worst enemy. Now, self-sabotage is a very sneaky pattern of behavior because it's not something we're consciously aware of what we're doing and getting in our own way. And this was a recurring problem, a recurring theme that I found both in the actors I work with and the students I was meeting too, that some of them were very talented, but just not applying themselves. So the Rise Above the Script, the foundation of it was my doctoral dissertation, my doctoral thesis. Because for my PhD project, I did self-defeating behavior in performing artists. That was my theme. And it was very interesting because I found that I learned a lot, particularly personality factors play a huge role into it. So one of the frameworks I use is called what we call the Big Five, the five essential personality traits, which are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, which are five fundamental traits that we all have. Now, some of us have varying degrees of that. What I found was two traits that really stood out for self-sabotage. Neuroticism, which refers to how well somebody copes. Now, someone high in neuroticism will tend to get very stressed out easily, get really affected by little things, and are prone to anxiety very easily. Now, another trait that's important is conscientiousness, which refers to discipline and focus and work ethic. And what I found is that it kind of an inverse or opposite relationship, that if you're high in neuroticism and low in conscientiousness, you're more likely to engage in self-sabotaging behaviors. So it kind of, you know, gave me the insight that what we need to do if we're going to develop, stop people from doing this, is to really develop these systems that I kind of talked about earlier, the schedules, the time blocking, and all of that. Because we want to increase our conscientiousness. And then what we can do is lower the temperature a bit on the anxiety and the reactivity so that we're able to be more focused and more disciplined and in a better frame of mind, because that will eliminate self-sabotage.
And do you offer ways that readers can use to do that?
Well, definitely. The first thing is important is keeping the schedule. Keeping a schedule, and also different ways of looking at, like, viewing failure as feedback and stepping stones rather than source of anxiety. Another thing, another reality a lot of creatives face is the word rejection, the idea of rejection. Because very often, especially actors and performers, are told no more than they're told yes. I mean, that's the reality of business. It's a very competitive industry. So the one thing that I really help actors to try to adopt the mindset of, there's no such thing as rejection, and reframing it as, it's just a gentle reminder that our services are not needed today. And I think if we refer to that, it takes away a lot of the personal element and the emotional charge out of getting that no, which can then help you stay focused.
Where can listeners find your book?
So you can find it on Amazon. It's available as a paperback and ebook. And you can also find it where most audiobooks are sold, because it's available in audiobook as well.
You're writing more books, aren't you?
Of course. Yeah. Once you write one, it's kind of like hard not to write others. So one book that I'm writing, which is kind of, I talked a little bit about this in my in Rise Above the Script, is People Pleasing. So my next book is helping you get out of that people pleasing trap, and which kind of also really falls under another theme, the martyr complex, which aids in self-sabotage. So it's going to be kind of like a slight, even though not directly, but a slight follow-up to Rise Above the Script.
Where can listeners learn more about your work or follow you?
The best way is LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn as under Albert Bramante. I write a lot of articles, including the one that you referenced a lot, yeah, about the ADHD. So I write a lot there. I post a lot of videos. And so I do a lot of like thought pieces. So you can follow me there. You can also go to my website at albertbramante.com.
Right. I'll attach the link to your website to the podcast. And then I have another question. I'm curious about your philosophy of life.
So my philosophy of life is that we're always evolving, we're always changing, and we're always a work in progress. So the way I look at things is to have excitement and the love of learning rather than being rigid. And what I would often say is, go live your dreams, in a sense, and do what you set out to do, not what other people tell you to do.
Thank you, Albert. Can I ask you a fun question?
Of course.
Okay. We're going to the realm of the imagination. If you could magically become a character in a movie or series and live that character's experiences as if in real life, which character would you choose?
Interesting question. I would probably have to say, I'm thinking like a detective, Columbo, I would probably imagine, because he had a superpower of connecting with people and figuring things out. So I would have to say, if I can be a Columbo, I would be.
Oh, I love those two traits, connecting with people and figuring things out.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Albert, for your insights and for putting such a different spin on ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Marietsneeman Journalist. The podcast series Calm, Clear and Helpful is produced by me, with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9.